did y'all each give your time allotments to the clerk?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, you're good. Yeah, you're good. Right. Then let's go ahead and just call this. As you know, that we are on an electronic recording system, so we're going to go ahead and call the case, and the recordings from today's proceedings will be available on the court's website in a few days. This is cause number 15713 CV, Brian DeRoque, Melinda Young, Catherine Boykin as co-trustees of the Walter A. DeRoque Q-Tip Trust, assignee of Texas Capital Bank et al., versus DHM Ventures, James Moritz, and Nathan Halsey. Okay. And for appellees?
Shelby O'Brien and Nathan Vickers.
Okay. And whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, Woody Jones for the appellants. The essential purpose of the acknowledgement doctrine is to prevent debtors from wiggling out of their legitimate obligations. This case exemplifies the benefits of that doctrine, and there is more than enough evidence to show all of the elements of an acknowledgement claim. And since this is a summary judgment, we only have to show more than a scintilla of evidence. I want to first talk about the liability of the primary obligor, DHM, and then I want to talk about the liability of the guarantors. The statute of limitations has not run as to DHM's indebtedness because there is some evidence of all the elements of an acknowledgement cause of action. An acknowledgement claim has four elements. The first is that the acknowledgement has to be in writing and signed by the party to be charged. In the present case, we have checks and emails, both of which are in writing by definition, and both of which are signed by the parties to be charged. And all of the checks and emails may be considered, not just the two checks and two emails that that came after limitations ran.
Counsel,
could you
tell the court which exhibits are the strongest claims for acknowledgement?
Well, with respect to the checks, Your Honor, they're pretty much all the same. They're all made out to the DeRoque Trust, and they all indicate at least the word interest. Now, there are a couple of them that actually include a month like May interest or December interest. With respect to the emails, there are some that are stronger than others. I pulled out a couple that I'll refer you to. One is Exhibit 6.13. That says, could you verify the interest that is owed and then the interest that will be due 9/30? DHM paid down the loan by $1,089,000. I would like to send in the interest and make the loan $7 million. Best Jim. And the evidence is that Jim is Jim Moritz, one of the guarantors. Exhibit 6.8, the subject line says, I can make our interest payment this month for DHM. And it says, so I let Jim know I will cover this month's interest, and et cetera, et cetera. I told Jim he should not have to plan to budget for any additional capital contributions for DHM. I know we were a bit late this month, but I didn't get this confirmed until the end of my trip, and that is signed Nathan, that is Nathan Halsey, the other guarantor.
Which one is, which exhibit is that, please?
The first one was 6.13.
Right, I've got that one out.
The second was 6.8.
6.8, thank you.
But a lot of the other emails contain similar language, but in scanning through it, this was some of the strongest that I found. The second element of an acknowledgement claim is that the acknowledgement or the writing must contain an acknowledgement of the justness or existence of the obligation. That is, something has to be in writing that shows that the debt exists. In this case, we have the checks for payment of interest on a debt. And those checks have often been held sufficient to be an acknowledgment as long as all of the elements of an acknowledgment claim are met. Emails are roughly the equivalent of letters, and emails or letters have also been held in many cases to be able to constitute an acknowledgment in writing of an indebtedness. The third element of an acknowledgment claim actually falls into two subparts. The overall statement of the element is the acknowledgment has to refer to the obligation and express a willingness to pay it or honor it. So the first sub-element is it has to refer to the obligation. Now, in a case like we have here, where the acknowledgment refers to an obligation but does not specifically identify which obligation you're talking about, that is referred to as a general acknowledgment. And a general acknowledgment brings into play three rules. The first rule is where there is only one debt between the parties, a general acknowledgment is sufficient to show that that's the debt that is referred to. The second rule is that a general acknowledgment puts the burden on the debtor to show that there are additional debts, if in fact there are additional debts. And the third rule is, if it's necessary, extraneous evidence, including parole evidence, can be used to show which specific indebtedness the general acknowledgment is referring to. The second subpart of element three is it has to express a willingness to honor or pay the debt. That is actually an easy one here, because many Texas cases have recognized the rule that a sufficient acknowledgement imports or implies a promise to pay the debt, as long as the acknowledgement is unaccompanied by any circumstances that would imply an unwillingness to pay it.
Mr. Jones, the Stein case says the amount of debt must be susceptible of ready ascertainment. What's your position as of what date must it be readily ascertainable? At the time of the acknowledgement? Today?
Well, the first point is the amount due does not have to appear on the acknowledgement doctrine itself. There simply has to be some means by which you can readily ascertain the amount due. And that can be either at the time of the acknowledgement or later. It's simply, you have to be able to show how much is due. And that is the fourth element of an acknowledgement claim. And it is easily met here through any number of the statements, bank statements that show exactly how much was due. $7 million was due as of the end of 2013, plus some $58,000 or so of interest at that time.
And has interest continued to accrue since the suit was filed? And if so, can the total amount due still be readily ascertainable?
Absolutely. The note itself, and again, an acknowledgement is a new promise to pay the old debt. So the note represents the old debt. And all you have to do is look at the terms of the note to see what the interest rate would be post-maturity.
In this conversation, if I understand from your opening remarks, we're talking about as to DHM.
Yes.
We're not talking about the guarantors individually yet.
Not yet. I'm just getting to that right now. So that again shows that the liability of DHM has not been exhausted by the statute of limitations. Let me turn now to the guarantors. Limitations has not run as to the guarantors. The appellees argue that there has to be some sort of separate individual acknowledgement by the guarantors in that capacity in order for the guarantee to apply. And that is not the law. All that's required is that the underlying obligation be extended and that the guarantors have consented to the extension. And in the present case.
So then there is no need to make demand upon the guarantors then? It's just their acknowledgement is, it assumes?
Their acknowledgement, their consent to the extension simply means that the guarantees that they signed still apply to the underlying indebtedness. Now, whether or not demand has to be made, that's another issue that I was going to mention later. Frankly, the briefs hashed that issue out pretty thoroughly. Okay. So in the interest of time, I'll probably skip over that. But it does not impact the fact that with consent by the guarantors, the guarantees still apply. Here in the present case.
What's the import of this court's holdings pre-reversal from the Supreme Court in this case in regard to the guarantors? What's the import of that?
In regard to which?
Well, we made some holdings in the original appeal before the Supreme Court reversed us. What's the import of the language in the first opinion regarding the guarantors?
Are you talking about footnote 5?
Sure.
Yes. Let me address that. The appellees did not make that argument in their appellee's brief, but they've now picked up on it from footnote 5. Footnote 5 referred to elements 3 and 4 of a claim on a guarantee, which was arguably part of the no evidence motion for summary judgment. I want to be very clear that elements 3 and 4 that were referred to are not elements 3 and 4 of an acknowledgement claim. They're elements 3 and 4 of a claim on a guarantee, totally different. The appellate said, and this court alluded to, it didn't actually hold, mm-hmm. This court opined in footnote 5 that the appellant should have challenged elements 3 and 4 in their appellant's brief. Mm-hmm. There are two reasons why that is not the case. First, that DHM and the two guarantors, let me back up. Elements 3 and 4 of a claim on a guarantee are very simple. Element 3 is simply, has the underlying obligor paid? Element 4 is simply, has the guarantor paid? And those were just not contested issues, in this case. There is simply no question. And let me show you how that plays out. In the statement of facts section of the appellant's brief, it was stated that after December 2013, no payments had been made on this obligation by anybody. Rule 38.1 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure provides, quote, in a civil case, the court will accept as true the facts stated unless another party contradicts them. In their appellee's brief, the appellees made no attempt to contradict the statement that neither DHM nor the guarantors had made any payments because, of course, they could not contradict that. It was not a disputed issue. In short, with all respect, footnote 5 in this court's earlier opinion came out of the blue. The appellees had not argued it, and it simply doesn't apply. The sole issue in this case has always been limitations. If you look at the appellee's brief, the first words in that brief are, quote, this appeal hinges on whether appellant's claims against appellees were brought within the statute of limitations, close quote. That is the issue in this case. So not only does this court have to accept as true that neither DHM nor the guarantors have made any payments on this, but also the appellee's motion for summary judgment that referenced elements 3 and 4 of a guarantee claim, that only went to the appellant's original cause of action on the promissory note. After that motion for summary judgment, the appellants filed a an amended petition in which they added the acknowledgement claim. An acknowledgement claim is based on a totally different contract, a totally different agreement. And when the appellees came back and filed what is in effect a supplemental motion for summary judgment, they did not raise elements 3 and 4 of a guarantee claim, as against the acknowledgement cause of action. Therefore, it really doesn't apply to the acknowledgement cause of action at all, irrespective of whether this court was required to accept as true the failure of DHM and the guarantors to pay. So it's two completely separate bases why that waiver argument fails.
If addressing a potential acknowledgement claim by the guarantors, or rather that the guarantors acknowledge the claim, if a check paying interest is drawn from DHM's bank account, but it's signed by a guarantor, can that check demonstrate an acknowledgement of debt by the guarantor, by DHM, or by both, or just by DHM? Or what's your position on that?
Your Honor, I think by both. First, we're talking about it's paid on the bank account of DHM. So DHM is actually the one that was making these payments. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, all you need, in addition to the extension of the underlying indebtedness, all you need is that the guarantors have consented to the extension. And here, they not only signed continuing guarantees, the guarantees they signed specifically said they were continuing guarantees and would apply to any extension, renewal, modification, rearrangement, et cetera, of the underlying debt. So that by itself is enough, that this was pre-authorized by the continuing guarantee. And number two, the fact that the checks and emails were signed by the guarantors themselves is more than a scintilla of evidence that they consented at the time of the extension. They had already consented previously by signing the continuing guarantee, but by signing the checks and emails, they also consented at the very time, because it was those documents that represented the acknowledgments which had the effect of extending the underlying indebtedness. I see my time is up. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Ms. O'Brien.
May it please the court. My name is Shelby O'Brien. I represent the appellees in this matter, DHM Ventures, James Moritz, and Nathan Housie. This case started out as a suit on a note that is undisputedly barred by limitations. Now, opposing counsel talked about the policy behind the acknowledgement claim. I would like to flag that there's also a policy in this state that you can't bring stale claims. And exceptions to the statute of limitations tend to be narrowly construed, such as the discovery rule. This acknowledgement doctrine, while technically a new promise to pay, is essentially an exception to the statute of limitations in suits on debts. And the elements for an acknowledgement claim, as the Supreme Court said in the Stein v. Stewart case, and said again in the opinion in this case, are very specific. First, the acknowledgement agreement must be in writing and signed by the person to be charged. It must contain an unequivocal acknowledgement of the justness or existence of the debt or of the particular obligation. And it must refer to the obligation and express a willingness to pay it. All three elements must be met. Our brief sets forth, I think, in detail, both our brief the first time around here, which is still before the court, I think set forth in a lot of detail why the writings that the trust is relying on are not acknowledgments as a matter of law as to DHM. As the Houston Court of Appeals said in the Metal v. Kverner Processes case in 2004, the modern trend is to not twist vague writings into acknowledgments when the language does not clearly import this construction. We believe that under the elements for an acknowledgement claim, the writings the trust is referring to fail as a matter of law as to DHM.
In your brief, you've argued that we should only consider the checks and emails that were generated after the period of limitations ran. But what do you make of cases like Caterpillar and the Supreme Court in this case, who said the acknowledgement can come before or after the suit on the original debt is barred by the statute of limitations?
The Supreme Court said that in dicta, and I agree that there are some older cases suggesting that as well. I believe under the language of the statute, if you actually look at the language of the acknowledgement statute, I don't believe if this issue was fully briefed before the Supreme Court, that's what they would hold. And the federal courts in Texas, by the way, say the opposite
then
for good
would,
reason.
Then what would be the purpose of sending it back here then?
The purpose of sending it back
if it's dicta in this case.
Well, the Supreme Court's opinion was solely dealing with the pleading issue. So now we're back here on the essentially the merits of the summary judgment. In terms of whether the writings were an acknowledgement and whether there's any evidence to support the claims against the guarantors.
So do you concede that the trust has presented some evidence of acknowledgement of debt if we consider all the checks and emails, including those generated before the limitations period ran?
Absolutely not. Those are vague statements that are not unequivocal in nature. And
The Supreme Court said, and I'll quote, the acknowledgement can come before or after suit on the original debt barred by limitations. And that's the part that's dicta? It seems quite plainly stated.
I'm not disputing the Supreme Court said okay. that. We believe that the writings, both before and after limitations expired, did not meet that unequivocal standard set forth in Stein. I plan to spend, though, all of my time today. I believe the briefs deal quite well with DHM and plan to spend the remainder of my time on the guarantors. And there are two reasons why the summary judgment should be affirmed as to the guarantors. First, the trust waived a no evidence challenge to the summary judgment. And second, even if there was no waiver, the trust presented no evidence supporting any claim against the guarantors. So I'll start with the waiver argument. And this court, in its previous opinion, expressly stated that it could affirm the summary judgment for the guarantors on the basis of the no evidence grounds for summary judgment alone.
And so what's your response then to Mr. Jones' comment about footnote number 5? What do you believe then? Where is footnote number 5? Is that a holding? Is that dicta? Do we have to follow that? What's your position?
It wasn't the holding of the court. It would have been dicta of this court that it could have affirmed on those grounds alone. And now that issue is back before this court again. I think it's important to look at the background of this case. The guarantors moved for summary judgment on two grounds. The first was the limitations ground with a traditional motion for summary judgment, and the second was no evidence grounds on the guarantees. The trust on appeal had the burden of attacking all independent grounds that could have supported the summary judgment, and it simply did not attack the no evidence grounds. Now, I understand the trust is arguing that the elements for a suit on a guarantee have no application with an acknowledgement claim. But that isn't how guarantee agreements work. DHM is the maker of the note. It's the obligor. The guarantors individually have no liability whatsoever they didn't borrow the money. The only thing that ties them to that loan is that they sign guarantee agreements. And the guarantee agreements, if you look at them, guarantee indebtedness. So any suit against the guarantors has to be under the guarantee agreements. That's the only thing that could possibly tie them to those loans since they didn't borrow the money. And it doesn't matter whether the underlying debt is the original promise by DHM to pay the debt or any supposed new promise by DHM to pay the debt. You still can only get to the guarantors through the guarantee agreements. So they had the burden of challenging every, they had the burden of challenging on appeal the no evidence grounds for summary judgment on the guarantee agreements. They didn't do so, and therefore it is waived, and footnote 5 was correct. But even if this court believed there was no waiver in terms of the guarantors, there's still no evidence to support an acknowledgement claim against the guarantors. So again, I think it's worth highlighting. The guarantors did not borrow the money. They signed guarantee agreements in the event DHM didn't pay. The only obligation the guarantors would have to the trust is through the guarantee agreements. And there is simply no evidence here that these writings the trust is referring to were individual acknowledgments, personal individual acknowledgments on the part of the guarantors. And there's also no evidence that the guarantee agreements even cover any purported new promise. I dispute that the guarantee agreements, guarantee agreements must be construed strictly. If there's any ambiguity, it's construed in favor of a guarantor. That's black letter law from the Texas Supreme Court and from this court. And if you look at the guarantee agreements, given that an acknowledgement is a supposed new promise, not a modification or an extension or so forth, I think under the strict language of the guarantee agreements, it would not apply to the new promise.
But Ms. O'Brien, doesn't the guarantee agreement repeatedly refer to not just modifications, but renewals, extensions, modifications, and rearrangements of the indebtedness in several sections on page 2, I believe page 3, page 4, page 5. They continually say this applies to all of those things that I just mentioned. So is it your position that an acknowledgement cannot be any of those things?
That's correct. An acknowledgement is a new promise. It's a new debt, a new promise. And I would dispute that. And there is no case from any court in this state dealing with a guarantee agreement and saying that a new promise is somehow an extension or a modification. In fact, it's the opposite. The idea is that it's a new promise to pay a debt.
What about in addressing these individual emails that Mr. Jones was talking about, where you have individual guarantors who have their name on the bottom of a subject, on the bottom of the signature line, and it doesn't say, you know, on behalf of DHM Ventures, it just says their first name, Jim, you know, et cetera. What's your response as to that?
Well, Mr. Moritz and Mr. Housey are members of the LLC. So, of course, they would be the ones paying interest or sending emails. I mean, the entity cannot do so. It has to act through its members. But there's one thing, I think LLC members throughout the state would be surprised to learn that when they act on behalf of an LLC, that somehow it imputes individual liability to them. There is absolutely no evidence that anything, any of those emails, any of those checks was somehow a personal new promise by the guarantors. And incidentally, Mr. Moritz, in his affidavit attached to the summary judgment motion, specifically stated that he paid interest as president of DHM. He actually wrote the words, "in my capacity as president of DHM." There's nothing, no evidence that he was making any statement individually. Not one of the documents that the trust refers to uses the word guarantee, makes any individual promise. I think it's also worth noting, to the extent that the trust is referring to these vague statements that say the word interest in a check or an email inquiring about the amount of interest, any agreement to pay the debt of another actually has to be in writing under the statute of frauds. There is no writing that they can point to where the guarantors individually promise to pay this supposed new debt. And incidentally, there is some precedent from this state that expressly states that a statement by one person cannot bind a guarantor, and that's the Vacrinos case that from the Fort Worth Court of Appeals that we cited in our opinion. In that case, the Fort Worth Court expressly stated that a statement by one guarantor cannot bind another with an acknowledgement claim. That's actually the general rule nationwide, that any statement, any new promise by an obligor does not constitute a new promise by the guarantor. That's what the Tenth Circuit held in the FDIC v. Peterson case. It's a case from 1985 where they expressly held that a statement by the obligor, even if that statement is an acknowledgement by the obligor, you can't somehow impute that to a guarantor. Also, as mentioned, Texas courts construe guarantee agreements in favor of guarantors and only finds individual liability in accordance with their strict terms. So in sum, when you consider that an acknowledgement must be an unequivocal promise to pay a debt, that it must refer to the obligation, again, there's nothing in any of these writings referring to a guarantee or to a guarantee agreement, with the fact that guarantee agreements are construed in favor of guarantors, and that the nationwide general rule is that a statement by an obligor that may constitute an acknowledgement cannot constitute an acknowledgement by the guarantor, this court should hold that there's no evidence to support the acknowledgement claim against the guarantors. Now, opposing counsel mentioned that the guarantor somehow consented to any acknowledgement by DHM. This would be truly a novel standard under Texas law, that a guarantor, simply by being aware that an obligor has made a new promise to pay, that a guarantor somehow becomes liable for that new promise, when a guarantee agreement must be in writing, when a guarantor has no attachment to a loan outside of a guarantee agreement. That can't be the rule, and there's actually no Texas case that supports that. And it would also violate the statute of frauds again by essentially implying a new guarantee when it isn't in writing. So we believe that the judgment in favor of DHM should be affirmed, but even if this court believes there's a fact issue as to DHM, the court should nonetheless affirm the judgment in favor of the guarantors. And I'm happy to answer any additional questions. Arnie? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very quickly, Your Honors. There is no ambiguity in these guarantee agreements. The two guarantee agreements are identical. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, they specifically say this will apply to any renewal, extension, modification, rearrangement. If this court were to hold that, well, that doesn't apply to an acknowledgement, that would be the essence of exalting form over substance. Consent is all that's required on the part of the guarantor, consent to the extension. There does not have to be a new promise by the guarantor in the capacity as guarantor. If the guarantor consents to the extension of the underlying indebtedness, that has the effect, the legal effect, of having the guarantee continue on and apply to the underlying indebtedness. And as I mentioned in my opening remarks, the guarantors here consented in two different ways. One, by signing a continuing guarantee, and two, by actually signing the checks and emails that constituted the acknowledgments themselves.
Counsel, suppose DHM acknowledged the debt, do the guarantors automatically remain liable? Is it your position that they automatically remain liable for that debt, or that they're only liable if they acknowledge their continuing liability as guarantors?
I think the guarantors have to consent to the extension in some way. Here they've consented in two different ways. One, in advance by signing the continuing guarantee, and two, they consented at the time of the extension by signing the checks and emails. Whether that constitutes a new promise is irrelevant. It constitutes their knowledge of the extension and their consent to the extension.
But in this factual scenario, then, there would be no way for them not to consent with the, you know, pre-printed DHM checks. I mean, how could they send a payment without consenting to the extension?
Under the facts of this case, that's absolutely right. I mean,
So every payment is an extension? Every payment would be an extension?
That's right. Given the fact that they had already signed a continuing guarantee, promising that the guarantee would follow along any extension, renewal, et cetera, then that was all the consent that was needed.
And in your brief, you argued that the limitations don't begin as to the guarantors until a demand is made of the guarantors. What are your best cases in which limitations begin to run at one time for the principal debtor and then at another time for the guarantors?
Well, you've got two different contracts. You've got the underlying obligation, and then you've got the guarantee agreements. It's the guarantee agreements that specifically say in Section 2 that the guarantors promise to pay upon demand any amount that DHM has not paid.
Well, let me also then direct your attention, though, to one other portion of the agreement. Doesn't it also say in the trust agreement that payment is due on page 3 under Section 4B in the event of default? Such guaranteed payments are due, whether it's by terms, acceleration, or otherwise, guarantors shall promptly pay the amount due therein to lender without notice or demand.
Yes, Your Honor. And as we laid out in our, I think it was our reply brief, there is an inconsistency. And we tried to show how that inconsistency should be resolved. But frankly, that's a whole separate issue that does not impact the consent given by the guarantors for the extension. If this court wanted to look into that, the issue of whether a demand was required, that's all well and good, but it's not essential to a resolution of this case at all. And that's why I said that I'm going to leave that to the briefs, because both briefs hashed that out pretty thoroughly. What I'm trying to rely on is simply the black letter law that if there's an extension of an underlying agreement and the guarantor consents in one way or another to that extension, then the guarantee will follow the extension. Now, one last point.
Real quick.
Council cited the Vacronos case. In that case, that case is distinguishable for a couple of reasons. First, the guarantors did not sign a continuing guarantee. So there was not a consent in advance. So what they needed was the guarantors to consent at the time of the extension, and only one of the two guarantors consented. And all the court held was that guarantor's consent doesn't carry over to the other guarantor, which is absolutely correct law, but it doesn't apply in this case. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to the parties. And with that, the case will be submitted and this court will be adjourned.
All these-